This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. Americans have descended into a mass collective trauma over the past several months since the election. Many of us cannot believe that a man such as Donald Trump now occupies the White House, and the barrage of assaults on constitutional protections, minority rights, immigrants and refugees have left us struggling to respond fast enough. The rise of anti-Semitism and white nationalist hate groups coinciding with Trump's tenure has also provoked a fear of fascism in the U.S. While it seems far-fetched to imagine a dictatorial era emerging out of Trump, it can be a useful exercise to examine history and learn in particular from what emerged in Germany before World War II. My guest is Sir Richard J. Evans. He is a preeminent historian, the author of The Coming of the Third Reich in Power, and The Third Reich at War, which are now available as paperbacks from Penguin Press. His newest book is The Pursuit of Power, Europe, 1815 to 1914. He is a Regius Professor Emeritus of History at Cambridge University, President of Wolfson College, Cambridge, and Provost of Gresham College, London. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Hi, nice to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, how have you viewed the rise of Trump from across the Atlantic, given that just a few months before, your country experienced the trauma of Brexit that many people have compared to what has transpired in the United States?
Yeah, there's clearly a mood in the democracies, particularly among people who feel that they have been hammered by globalization, that they're victims of globalization, that their lifestyle, that they has been marginalized, that they have not gained economically over the last 20 years or so, that they've been ignored by political elites. And what we're seeing, I think, both in my country, the UK, and the USA, is a revolt of groups who feel that they've been deprived in this way.
So at the heart of it, of course, is the economic struggles of ordinary people. And it's always easy for politicians to whip up resentment against minority groups as scapegoats. They are the ones taking away your jobs. Looking back at history, was this the kind of rhetoric that we saw in Germany aimed at Jews?
Well, there's similarities and differences. I mean, it's very interesting that, yes, this rhetoric was aimed at Jews in the 1920s. But remember, in Germany, the Jews were less than 1% of the population. It's a really tiny minority. Other minorities were targeted, but in a different way. So the Jews were seen as a kind of world conspiracy to destroy Germany and blamed for Germany's loss in the First World War. And I think there are big differences here. So the whole of the 1920s and in the 1930s were in the shadow of the First World War. Germany lost. The Italians felt that they'd lost. Russian Empire had been effectively destroyed. Revolution had taken over with Lenin, the Bolsheviks. And above all, it's a time of a brutalization of politics, of mass movements of uniformed armed stormtroopers on the streets of Germany and Italy in particular, and other countries like Austria and so on. It's a time when the politics is militarized, and violence played an enormous part in the downfall of the Weimar Republic. People in Germany blamed the democracy that had come to power at the end of the First World War for all their ills. The massive depression in the early 1930s, with over a third of the workforce unemployed, far greater than anything you can see today. And that kind of violence, I think, is no longer acceptable. We know that it led to World War, to genocide, to the Holocaust. And you don't see politicians now anywhere really putting hundreds of thousands of armed men onto the streets to beat up and kill their opponents.
However, there was a report that emerged out of the White House that was verified but then denied by the White House that Trump was considering mobilizing the U.S. National Guard to deport immigrants. It might have been a sort of trial balloon for the administration to see how it would be received by the public. And when it was met with outrage, they might have scuttled it.
Yeah.
What about this demonization of Islam and Muslim people as an analogy towards what Jews have faced, keeping in mind that today in the United States, Jews are also being targeted. We're seeing rising anti-Semitism, but Muslims in particular, which Trump openly targets, you know, in using the term radical Islamic terrorism, this is a phenomenon that has actually impacted startlingly few people directly in the United States, but Trump manages to scare Americans.
That's right. Yes. I mean, I to come to the first, back to the first point for a moment, I think anyone who wants to establish some kind of authoritarian regime now has to use the state. They have to use the army, the police, National Guard, if you like, and that, or its equivalents. So there has, there's a rather a different situation. They have to use the armed and military arm of the state. As for scapegoating and targeting, yes, I think there is a worrying similarity, at least in the rhetoric that's used by some of President Trump's team about radical jihadist Islamists pointing a dagger at the heart of America and intending to destroy the whole of American civilization. That's quite similar to what the Nazis said about the Jews. Of course, you have to remember that it's not until the World War from 1939 in Europe, I know the Americans entered in 1941, to 1945, that the Nazis then, under the conditions of war, move over to mass murder. But there were certainly many attacks on Jews in Germany and Austria before 1939. There were no extermination camps, that came later. And there was a climate of both of fear of this supposed Jewish conspiracy against Germany and of aggression towards Jews, who, of course, there wasn't a conspiracy. They bore no responsibility. It's all most Jews in Germany, as I said, a tiny minority, were liberal or conservative. They were not radical revolutionaries. They were not interested in destroying the German state. They wanted to live in it and prosper like everyone else. So it is worrying that there have been anti-Semitic attacks both in rhetoric against cemeteries, and it's very heartening to see that some Muslim organizations in the United States are helping with the restoration of Jewish cemeteries. I think in any minority groups who are targeted in this way have to come together to defend themselves.
Right. And it took Trump several days to actually even denounce anti-Semitism. The first few times he was asked about it, he simply got defensive, which was frightening. Now, what about the relationship between Trump and the Republican Party? What historical lessons are there, say, for the relationship between Hitler and the German National People's Party? There's the sense that the Republican Party is going to control Trump, that they're going to bring him to heel, that they're going to kind of tame some of his most unpredictable and kind of radical notions. Was there a similar sense in Germany?
Yeah, okay. Just on the issue of anti-Semitism, of course, it's very worrying that the White House did not make any mention of the Jews on Holocaust Memorial Day.
Yes.
And when pressed upon this, that they said they wanted to be inclusive. But it's very important to remember that the Jews in Nazi Germany were targeted as existential threats to German existence, complete paranoid conspiracy theory. But that's, they were targeted especially. So Nazi policy during the war was to get as many Jews out of Germany as possible, to deport them. During the war, it was to kill all the Jews wherever they could be found, because all of them were seen to be this existential threat. And mass murder of Slavs. I mean, over 3 million Russian prisoners of war were killed by the Nazis. It's often forgotten, but that was to get them out of the way. It wasn't because they were seen as an existential threat. So there's a difference, and that's why Holocaust Memorial Day, while we remember all the other victims of Nazism, homosexuals, Gypsies, Jehovah's Witnesses, even Slavs, so-called, it's important to realize that the Jews were different, and there's a higher level of hatred and fear. So that's a very important point. Now, coming back to the next question you asked.
Yes.
The Nazis got 37% of the vote in Germany in 1932, the highest percentage, and they were unable to improve on that. That's as much. That's a very respectable. I mean, many governments in democratic countries come into power with 37% of the vote. They were put into power when they lost votes in the November elections of 1932. They were seen as being weak. And so there's a conservative nationalist party that went into coalition. Hitler was the chancellor, the head of the government, in January 1933. But the nationalists, as you said, the DNVP, the Nationalist Party, were in coalition with them and hoped to control Hitler. They thought, a lot of people thought, he'll calm down after he comes into government. And in any case, there's a majority of these conservatives in the government, and they thought they'd be able to control him. Now, their weakness, and this is a really important difference, I think, their weakness was they had almost no electoral support. Almost all of their voters had deserted to the Nazis. They only had a small number of votes. In March 1933, there were fresh elections were held. That's part of the deal to appoint Hitler as chancellor, as head of the government. And even on conditions where it was very difficult because of intimidation, bullying, threats, and so on, for the opposition parties to campaign, still, the Nazis only got 44% of the vote. And the other 8% were the nationalists. 44%, 8%, you can see the nationalists are in a really weak position, quite unlike the Republicans today, who are in a very strong position in both houses of Congress. Right. So they were unable in 1933 to control Hitler. He was able to use mass violence on the streets, which again is something we haven't seen in the United States, and able to use the fact that he had this mass electorate behind him, which the nationalists, the conservatives, did not have.
Are there similarities that we can draw between the rhetoric that Trump has expressed and Hitler's rhetoric? This America first, make America great again, these simplistic slogans that he really has been able to use effectively to kind of, you know, get his to broaden his base.
Yeah, absolutely. Almost the only interesting part of Hitler's notorious autobiographical tract, Mein Kampf, My Struggle, is where he talks about propaganda. He talks about how to win over the masses. And he says you've got to have simple slogans and repeat them endlessly. They didn't really mean very much, so his slogan didn't necessarily have any policy implications, but you do that. And there is a sort of similarity there. On the other hand, Trump kind of shoots from the hip, like in one of the old Westerns. You know, he doesn't think before he speaks. His speech last night's different. It's clearly carefully prepared. But normally, you know, he tweets away in the early hours of the morning without really thinking about what he's going to say. Everything Hitler did was very carefully prepared. All his speeches were thought out in advance. Sometimes he rehearsed them before he actually went on to give them. I think that's a big difference. There's nothing really spontaneous there about what Hitler said, despite the appearance of being spontaneous.
Now, we don't just remember Hitler, but we remember Goebbels. We remember his right-hand men, if you will. Trump has surrounded himself by Stephen Miller, by Steve Bannon, by some of these dangerous figures whose rhetoric, you know, is a little bit more extreme than Trump's. Does that also offer a clue as to the kind of leader Trump is, where he takes advice from a small, tightly woven group, a cabal of both sort of men who might serve as yes men, but then also kind of steer him in a direction because he's easily manipulated?
Yeah, there's certainly similarities there. So Hitler did exactly the same. He surrounded himself with advisors whose power came from the fact they were close to him, not from the offices that they held. And in fact, although they were government ministers and he appointed one after another to the cabinet until they outnumbered the conservatives and forced them out, but these men at Goebbels, Goering, Robert Ley, Himmler eventually, their power came because it came to them because they were close to Hitler. And in fact, the cabinet, once Hitler had got the parliament by a mixture of intimidation, threats, and various offers to agree by a two-thirds majority that the cabinet alone could make laws, didn't need the parliament anymore, didn't need the president, as a figurehead in Germany in the 30s, but still they can make it. Then the cabinet more or less fell into disuse, and it was just Hitler and his friends. The cabinet wasn't beating at all by 1939. It just sort of withered away and atrophied. So I think there's a kind of similarity there about these surrounding yourself with people, not because they hold a constitutional office, but because they're close to you. But I think it's a difference as well. And that is, there's never any doubt in Nazi Germany that's Hitler who wrote the scenarios, who set the pace, who set the tone. He's the one in charge. He's driving all the rest of them. I think the Trump and his advisors, it's rather different. It's because sometimes it's rather difficult to see, and President Trump being consistent about things, and it's difficult to discern any kind of overall policy thrust. And you get the sense that his advisors have much more power and much more influence over him than, say, Hitler's did over him.
Hmm. Well, we only have a few weeks to examine of Trump as president. We're going to have you back on maybe in a few months or a year. Let's turn to Trump's attitude towards the courts, the judiciary in the United States. Very early, he showed a lack of understanding of the role of the judiciary in the American system of government, and referred to judges who struck down his executive orders as so-called judges. Even during his campaign, he showed disdain for judges. Does that have any echoes in Hitler's relationship towards the court system in Germany?
Well, there are differences. So, I mean, of course, in the United States, the Constitution has these three pillars of the Constitution are meant to counterbalance each other, the legislature, the presidency, and the courts. The courts are very robust in the United States. And I think they're in a very important means of defending democracy, human rights, and so on. Whereas in Nazi Germany, I think the courts were much more sympathetic to start with the Nazis. Most judges had been appointed under the Kaiser before the First World War. They hated the Weimar Republic. They were very conservative. They welcomed the Nazis coming to power insofar as they promised a kind of return to order, bringing the death penalty back, which had more or less gone in the Weimar Republic, and so on. However, they did have a respect for the law. It's interesting that in the first months of 1933, when the Nazi stormtroopers were running riot all over Germany, arresting, imprisoning in concentration camps, communists and socialists who were opponents of the Nazis, there were a lot of prosecutions, thousands of prosecutions of stormtroopers for acts of violence and acts of mayhem and breaking the law and so on. These are eventually quashed by Hitler. But the Supreme Court in Nazi Germany, the Reich Court, was set to by the Nazis to try the alleged perpetrators of the Reichstag fire. Now, to explain, in the end of February 1933, the National Parliament was burned down. It seems, although there's argument about it, it seems that this is burnt down by a lone, somewhat deranged Dutch anarchist. And then he was put on trial by the Nazis with a lot of communist leaders who the Nazis blamed in a conspiracy theory. And that was a justification of their taking over emergency powers. Now, the court dismissed all the charges against everyone apart from this Dutchman. They didn't do the Nazis' bidding. And what Hitler then did was to set up a parallel system of courts, which he could control, so-called People's Court at their head, and then the special court. So the courts did actually show some resistance to Hitler's rule.
And I'm so glad you brought that up, the Reichstag fire, as it's called. And a lot of people are worried about that sort of thing happening here in the United States. We saw on September 11th, 2001, how a horrific terrorist attack opened the door for wars that continue today, for this system of war, for the emergence of the Department of Homeland Security, for all sorts of emergency powers. And Trump has tweeted in response to a judge striking down his Muslim travel ban, he tweeted, "Just cannot believe a judge would put our country in such peril. If something happens, blame him and the court system. And so in response to that, Americans are worried that tomorrow, if there is a horrific terrorist attack in the U.S., Trump has already warned us that it's going to be the judge's fault. That's really frightening.
Yeah, it is quite alarming. And I think it's very important to beware of a state government taking emergency powers. This was built into the constitution of the Weimar Republic, which still operated in the Third Reich in Hitler's time. And it provided for the president to declare emergency powers. And that meant the suspension of civil liberties, the right to arrest opponents of the regime, tapping of telephones, suppression of freedom of the press. And all of that was achieved by an emergency decree on the morning after the legislature of the Reichstag burnt down, on the pretext that it was a communist who burned it down. And that was a reason why, of course, Hitler was so angry with the Supreme Court for saying, no, it wasn't there. You can't prove it was the communists. And that Reichstag fire decree, as it's called, that suspension of civil liberties, effectively the suspension of the constitution, was renewed, just renewed and renewed and renewed right up to 1945, to the end of regime. And that's taking of emergency powers, I think, is a key step towards the establishment of a dictatorship. And of course, it's very easy to find a justification for that. In fact, the burning down of the Reichstag did not mean there was a communist attempted revolution. It's completely made up by the Nazis.
And Trump has already, of course, attempted to use the killings of Americans by a handful of undocumented immigrants as justification for building the wall in the U.S. Between the U.S. and Mexico. If something more dramatic were to happen, it's really quite frightening to imagine what he would do with that. Now, what about the role of rather Trump's relationship with and attitude towards the media, the U.S. media? I don't think has ever been in this position in recent memory as it is today, being labeled the enemy of the American people by Trump. Is there any lesson that we can learn from Hitler's relationship to the German media that might illustrate what's happening here in the U.S.?
Yeah, it's similar, incidentally, to some newspapers in this country, in the United Kingdom, which condemned judges who ruled that Parliament had to approve the law taking Britain out of the European Union, label those judges as enemies of the people. That's a phrase you find. Yeah. It's a very alarming phrase, and one that was used by the Nazis before the and during the Second World War. Certainly, the propaganda chief of the Nazis and then propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels, launched furious vitriolic attacks on the German press, what he called the lying Jewish press. In due course, during the Nazi seizure of power in the first months of 1933, newspapers were closed down or they were forced to print only Nazi news. The media were brought under control. Editors were fired. The Nazi publishing empire was built up so it could buy up oppositional newspapers. And the free press is very important for a healthy democratic society, and that's precisely, of course, because it can criticize the government. And if you don't criticize, if you don't have a free press that exposes corruption, for example, in the government, then you get a massive growth of corruption, as in the Nazi period. It was what some people have called a kleptocracy. In other words, the leading Nazis helped themselves to as much money and property as they could, and they were all millionaires by the time the Second World War broke out.
Now, Trump has had a very interesting relationship with the military and intelligence agencies here in the United States. Usually one needs, or, you know, when we think of sort of dictatorial regimes, the military really is needed to side with any dictator in order to maintain power. But Trump's relationship with the military is mixed. I mean, he's promised to boost the military budget, but many in the military they are sort of convinced that he doesn't understand much about how the U.S. has waged its wars. The intelligence community seems very strongly opposed to him. How did Hitler have, what sort of relationship did Hitler have with the German military? I mean, I think that's a pretty obvious question given the rise of Nazi Germany, but it seems as though there was much less contention there between those two institutions.
Yeah, well, that's because with the Treaty of Versailles that ended the that ended World War One when Germany was defeated, that's because the treaty imposed a limit of 100,000 men on the size of the German army. It banned the building or use of any combat aircraft or combat ships. It had a lot of provisions that really really restricted German military power. So it was quite easy for Hitler to offer the German military getting back to their old status, taking the lid off the Treaty of Versailles limits on the military power, building battleships, building combat aircraft, all the rest of it. That was very easy to win over the military. But also, there was a clear purpose to this. So you have to ask in any society, what's the military for? Why do we need it? It's very important because for that, you then judge whether or not we need a large military or a small one. Or do we have, let's say, more battleships or more aircraft carriers or more troops or more planes and so on. And in the case of Nazi Germany, the aim was very clearly understood by everybody from the start. And that is conquering and winning back the territories that were taken away from Germany in the west, the northwest, and particularly in the east in Poland by the Treaty of Versailles. And then the military were promised that when they'd reached full strength, they would be able to launch a war of conquest on Eastern Europe and get back what they lost in the First World War and make Germany the dominant power in Europe by force of arms. So everyone is very clear about what's going to happen. I think there's a real lack of clarity in discussions of about the military and about intelligence and so on in the United States at the moment. It's very unclear why, what's the point of having more troops, more weapons, more guns, spending more on the military. And I don't think the military in America, where it's already incredibly strong, I'm not sure that they really, that they know what it's for. Why do they need more resources? Why haven't they got enough already?
Right, we spend more on our military than many, many, many countries combined. Meanwhile, of course, there's a lot of folks struggling here. Well, is it worth it for us to fixate on whether Trump is skillful and a master manipulator or kind of stupid and childish and immature? I think these are also discussions that many of us find ourselves preoccupied with because it's tempting to focus on the personal and the personality. And I know books have been written on a similar vein about Hitler, personally speaking. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, if you look at Hitler, you it's not a very fruitful discussion as to whether he was mad or not. I mean, clearly, in most normal respects, he was completely normal. He was not a kind of not a lunatic. He wasn't crazy. You can say some of his policies were crazy, but they fitted into the political culture of the time and resonated with many, many German people. It's similarly, it's not really a very interesting or important question to ask, is Trump a fascist, as some people have been doing. It's more useful, you know, that gets you involved in definitions of what's fascism or what are the criteria and so on. Just as saying that somebody is mentally disturbed gets you into definitions of what is mentally disturbed. The key question, I think, is what are the threats to democracy? What are the threats to world peace? What are the threats to the survival of the world because of the massive scale of climate and increasing scale of climate change? I think you have to sort of make those questions more precise. Clearly, President Trump has some character flaws, but don't all politicians have some character flaws? I think you also have to look at it in the round. You have to look at his entourage, look at the people he's surrounded with. What are their policies? What do they want to do? You shouldn't fixate just on a single individual any more, I think, than one fixates on just on Hitler. though, as I said, it's clear that Hitler set the agendas and called the shots, and much more than I think President Trump does.
Well, finally, Richard, is it overblown for us to fear a slide towards fascism in the United States? Or are we, you know, maybe living at a time when democracy is a little bit stronger? We have much more access to peer-to-peer communication than we've ever had historically. We have a longer history of democratic institutions, perhaps. I'm not sure whether we should fear the slide to fascism or not.
Well, you know, I think you have to say, you have to put the idea of fascism on one side and, and look at how do we defend democracy? How do we defend our rights? We faced it to a degree in Britain with the defense of the sovereignty of Parliament as against attempts by the government to get round it in the whole debate about making policy for leaving the European Union. I think we have to look at democratic institutions and make sure that they remain strong and robust, and with that we can defend them against attempts to undermine or weaken them.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Richard, and I hope to have you back on in the future as we have more data to dig through with Trump's presidency. Thanks so much.
Okay, it's a pleasure.
My guest is Sir Richard J. Evans, a preeminent historian, author of several books on Nazi Germany, The Coming of the Third Reich in Power, The Third Reich at War. He is Regius Professor Emeritus of History at Cambridge University, President of Wolfson College, Cambridge, and Provost of Gresham College, London. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can sign up for our newsletter at risingupwithsonali.com to get daily emails with links to all our stories.